Yeah, I think it's that kindness and the generosity and the compassion that actually made a difference to these wonderful people. And they're all wonderful people. The slum people, people say, oh, it's very dangerous in the slums. And it is. It can be very dangerous because there's drugs and violence and all sorts of stuff. But every time I've been in the slums, these people are just noble and delightful and generous. Even when they have nothing and it's a boiling, it's like 35 degrees and your head's going to explode, and I've been filming and I'm standing there, my shirt's soaked, and a little old lady comes out and goes, excuse me, and puts a little stool out for me to sit on, and then brings me a glass of water. And I go, oh.
Incredible.
And I look at her and I go, oh my God, you know, this is too much for me. You know, it's like that kindness when people have nothing. He's often said, I don't want to preach from the pulpit. I want to be like Jesus walking the streets. And he does. I've seen him. He walks the streets. I've come behind him with a camera, and he's talking to people. He's walking. He spends 2 or 3 hours, maybe. Not now, because he's older.
Yeah.
But in the early days, he was just walking, striding the slums. Yeah. And you know, people would come up, Father Joe, you know. He's almost like a saint.
Yeah.
You know? And you could see that. You could see the happiness in all their faces, and he would have pocket money. You know, he'd have a few little baht in his pocket. Occasionally, he'd give people a little bit. You know, if somebody is suffering a bit, and oh, Father Joe, you know, and I wouldn't know what they're saying in Thai, but obviously somebody's struggling, and he'd go, oh, that's okay.
Yeah,
give me a bit of money. You know,
yeah.
But it's I think it's that kindness and the generosity and the compassion that actually made a difference.
I read recently where in the book it just had a simple paragraph that said, and I'm making this up now, you know, Islam is fighting Christianity, Christianity is fighting whoever, you know, whatever religious wars are on, and one religion fights the other in the name of God, and the other religion responds in the name of God. And yet, here they are both fighting for, ultimately, the same God. Well, it's a different God in their eyes, but ultimately the same recognition of a higher force.
Yeah.
And probably, in both eyes, a God who is meant to be love.
And it's funny, Father Joe, one of Father Joe's favourite quotes is, Jesus is a highly evolved Buddha.
Whoa!
Which is kind of, you know, coming out of the mouth of a, you know, Catholic priest. Sorry, Father Joe, I had to say that.
Oh, that's wonderful. Hey, I'm excited, Chip, about this particular episode. Did you hear those three excerpts?
I did. You're always excited, but they are worth getting excited about.
Yeah, mate, they're just sort of like, they invigorate me for what is to come. I tell you what else should invigorate you too, dear listeners, is our website. AJourneyWithBernie.co is calling you. There's a beautiful button in the top right-hand corner. What's it all about, Chip?
It's called Gifts for You, Bern, and we want people to click on that. It's going to take you to a page where you can give us your email address, and we will send to that email address all of these wonderful gifts that we're always banging on about in the episodes from our previous guests. So you're looking at what we've got, Louise Bennett's poems. We've got something from Mary Scott.
Mary Scott's coaching manual. Mm. But underneath the Gifts for You button is something else that we're launching now. We're adopting projects, dear people. We want the love to be given to the whole world through these projects. This particular first project, exciting one. The film of Father Joe's life.
A light in the slaughterhouse.
He's calling for $340,000, James Lingwood, and guess what? We're going to be the catalyst to make sure that film goes into the households all around the world, dear Chip. If you're interested in the Gifts for You, if you're interested in Father Joe's project, AJourneyWithBernie.co,
sir.
.co. AJourneyWithBernie.co. Love to see you there.
Chipster, this is the first time I'm looking at your face, mate, and you are far more excited than I am. And I'm usually excitement personified.
I know. It's going to be a hell of an episode.
Yeah, how did you do it?
Well, I hypnotized him. I dazzled him with the white hot force of my personality. And here we sit with Mr. James Lingwood for round two.
Is that Lingwood or Ringwood?
It's definitely Lingwood. I don't know where you got Ringwood. Where did that come from? I've never heard that
Dear
before.
Dear listeners, welcome back. We have got Mr. James Lingwood back in this studio because we had to. And Chip, enlighten me, please. Why did we have to bring back James? James has got a story to tell. Just give us the creme de la creme dot points.
So James has done a fantastic documentary on a Catholic priest who spent the last 50 years in the slums of Bangkok.
Yeah.
So his name's Father Joe Meyer. Father Joe Meyer. And James is currently in post-production, so he's looking to raise some funds to get the sound done, to get the editing done, to get all this stuff to finish the film, give you a polished product. And we need to get Father Joe's story through James's story too. So you're going to get a lot of story today. And there's going to be a lot of learning out of that, I reckon.
Yeah, yeah. And James won't mind me saying so. The thing that I'm very, very excited about, we have heard this story. It is an incredible story. It's a story that a book should be written about. There should be a movie about it, and there will be. But there is so much learning about our whole objective, Chip, around being that more joyful, happier, loving person. There are so many things to learn. So that's where I'm super excited, and in the process, let's promote this film so that you out there have the choice to support this story being told, so that the rest of the world, the global world, can actually hear it, because it is certainly worth hearing. Dear listeners, you are in for a super treat. Now, James, welcome back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
Well, mate, so glad to hear you speak English. All morning you've been speaking in your Indian accent to me, mate.
Well, I can continue if you want.
Are we still allowed to do that? No, I'm waiting for the Twitter storm to come down now, you know.
James, Father Joe, you met him a long, long time ago. Tell us about the meeting of Father Joe Meyer.
The first time I met Father Joe was, 15, it was probably 2007 or 2008, and I was in a hotel lobby where I was about, I was about to pitch a film to a couple of investors who had been arranged for a meeting with me. And what happened was, as we were waiting and these guys were wandering around with mobile phones strapped to their ears, more people started arriving, and it was like 15 or 20 people, and suddenly we were all ushered into this other private room. Yeah. And I'm thinking, oh God, I haven't brought my PowerPoint. I'm not prepared to speak to so many people. I thought it was a one-to-one. So we go into the room, and I'm thinking, now when do I start? Suddenly this man walked into the room. And he spoke for about 5 minutes. He told a story, a very harrowing story, and then walked out. And I thought, and I'm looking around the room, and everybody's crying. Tears are falling down their cheeks. 15 men and a couple of women, you know. And I'm just going, who was that? And what an incredible story, and what a way he had of telling that story. So I'd learnt that was actually Father Joe.
Did he steal your pitch?
I should have actually given him my pitch, because I think he would have probably done a better job than I would have.
Hey, can I tell you, even then, because we're going to learn about this incredible relationship that you've had with this man for all these years, but even then, first impression, what was the thing that stood out about him that was so different than others that you had met? What was the feature that made this guy you had to stand up and listen to him?
I think a disarming honesty, a sense of how to tell a story. You know, telling stories is not easy. You know, you're in front of an audience. How do you compel them to listen? How do you mesmerize them? How do you, you know, get them to listen to you attentively? He's obviously done it a lot of times. He's, you know.
Yeah.
The way he told that story, I think, was the thing that got me, apart from the story itself.
Yeah, yeah. But it sounds to me as if coming from that raw source of honesty and being prepared to offer that honesty, that truth, that rawness was the feature that made the story so attachable. You had to connect with the story. You could feel it because he was unafraid to share the feeling of it. I dwell upon that for a moment because that's a beautiful quality for all of us to contemplate.
Mm.
And secondly, it's interesting the road to become that quality of authenticity, raw authenticity.
And it was definitely an emotional connection that he had with every single person in that room. And that's an amazing ability that one person has.
Yeah.
And probably why he has done what he's done so successfully.
Yeah.
Can we just to linger on that point too, because I think this is really important, right? Because people always say honesty is the best policy. Yes, but I think honesty is also a very blunt tool. Now, you can deploy honesty productively. You can deploy it very destructively too. You said disarming honesty. That's what Father Joe had. Can you maybe with an example to bring it alive for us, when you say disarming honesty, how did he do that?
He doesn't mince his words. His conviction comes over whenever he talks. It's unmistakable and his trademark. He just does not mince words. He just tells
no pretense.
And there's no preachy stuff from the pulpit. It's very much, and he said it many times to me, he prefers to walk in the streets like Jesus did. He prefers to work with the poor.
Wow.
He doesn't want to preach to them.
Hey, around the table, because I don't want to put the philosophical burden on you, James, but the difference between head speak and heart speak, I'm referring to, it's so easy in that situation that you're describing to walk in there thinking about what I'm going to say and how I'm going to say it and to construct it. And yet it appeared to me that he didn't do that. He gave heart speak. Are we able to differentiate? How do you get into heart speak mode? Tough question around the table.
I think it's like when people say, you know, if you're going to write a script, that the word is, you know, you've got to get in touch with your emotions and you've got to write from a personal place.
Yeah.
And when you write from a personal place, there's an authenticity and an honesty to what you're writing.
Yeah.
I think it's the same thing with Father Joe. Of course, he's a very highly intelligent man and he's, you know, pretty rational in his thinking.
Yeah.
But I think when he gets in front of an audience or people and has to talk, he goes into the heart speak area he gets, he's very much in touch with his emotions. He's always been quite an angry man. He's always been incredibly volatile and passionate about what he believes in. And I think he goes into that mode. There's a mode he goes into to deliver the best possible, for the best possible outcome.
Yeah. But what's interesting there, he's unafraid to do so. I think others would perhaps like to be like that, but there is still, how will people perceive me if I show myself so rawly to an audience?
I'll tell you a story about that. The Father Joe the man and Father Joe the actor. You know, I often thought, are there two different people? Is there a dichotomy between the real person and the person who's acting? Am I getting the real Father Joe? So when I talk to him, obviously he's real. You know, he's talking to me and he's telling me a story. Some of the stories were so terrifyingly real and horrific that I would say, Father Joe, do you mind, you know, sitting in front of the camera while I film you telling that story again?
Yeah.
Because I was just moved by it to such a degree that I couldn't believe the story.
You know? Yeah.
and I turned the camera on him, and he would do exactly the same delivery.
Yeah.
So either he's the consummate actor in real life and in front of the camera, because I don't know anybody else who does that. I've filmed many people, and as soon as you film somebody, they do change slightly, and they think they've got to appear in a certain way and say things in a certain way, and they can't be themselves. He doesn't change a single degree. He is the same person.
Is that your definition of great acting?
Well, maybe it's great, the great actor of life.
Yeah. You know,
life's great actor.
Yeah.
He's able to just be who he is.
Yeah.
And really in acting, that's what you try to attain to be, you know?
Yeah. Although they say all the greatest actors, they actually make themselves feel the emotions this character's going through. They make the character true for himself. So in that regard,
yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah. I still reckon Jack Nicholson should not have won an Academy Award for his Loser Gets. Right. He didn't have to act. Hey, James, you referred to these great stories that need to be told about Father Joe. Don't jump timelines. A story not long after you first met him, as you think about the unfolding whole story of Father Joe, but there's an episode, there's an event, there's an activity when you first met him that brings this incredible character to life. Tell us one.
The first thing that pops into my mind is when I first started filming and there was a two-year-old girl who was blind and dumb, and deaf. And she was deaf, dumb, and blind because of AIDS, because her parents had given her AIDS. At 2 years old, they didn't want her anymore. So what they did was they threw her into the street. They put her into the street, right? Normal people would put if they don't want the baby or the girl, they'd put them in a basket and leave them somewhere perhaps for somebody to find. They just put her in the street, and then guess what? They ran her over repeatedly. They ran her over their own daughter, their own flesh and blood, this helpless little thing. She was taken to the hospital where somebody rang Father Joe up and said, look, we've got this little girl here. She's been run over by her parents. She's deaf, dumb, and blind, and we're not sure whether she's going to survive. Are you able to come and fetch her if she does survive? So a week later, a week and a half later, she did survive, and Father Joe came to the hospital, picked her up, and brought her back to the Mercy Centre. Now, when she arrived at the Mercy Centre, I filmed her first day. She was lying in a cot, and I remember walking towards the cot, and Father Joe was there, and he had his finger out, and she was holding his finger.
Yeah.
And that was the only thing, the only contact she had with humanity.
Yeah.
And I filmed that, and I just went, oh my. You know, like it affected me for quite a few hours afterwards, that whole story. And I've seen that girl now, recently. She's now 18, 20, and she's still alive. Yeah. She's got a few mental issues, but look, she's alive and she's well, and she's wonderful. And there was a day, there was halfway along the journey when she was about 8 or 10, and she was having to come to get a medication.
Yeah.
And they cut the kids come to a window and they get their medication from the nurses, and I was filming from behind the window. She was coming towards the window to get her medicine, and she's blind, you know, so she can't see, and she's going like this trying to get the medicine, and she and you know what, I just tears just rolled down my cheeks because I just knew her journey and where she'd been and how far she'd come.
Like I'm
a bit overcome.
Like I'm hearing that story now and I'm trying to work out what do I learn just from hearing it. You know. And I'm thinking like how deep can love be? Like what is the depth of love that is available in any human being? I mean, we ask the question about how to become a more loving human being. If it is the question, like, how deep can you dive into the love well? And who can you be? What can you feel like? That's just me hearing the story. What about you there watching it, James? Like, what was your experience?
Well, again, you know, the thing about filming documentaries, especially when you're filming, you know, fairly harrowing scenes that are uncomfortable, you as a filmmaker, as a human being, you've got to have a moral compass and you've got to decide, is this ethical? Is this, am I okay filming this, you know? And obviously I decided I was because the story had to be told. But I think that story affected me to such a degree. It was very early on in the filming.
Yeah.
And you know what? And people say, oh, so how come you've taken 15 years and you've taken all this time? Well, I haven't obviously been filming every day. I've gone backwards and forwards to Bangkok and filmed bits and pieces. But this, when you see something like that and you hear that story and you film it, how can you not continue? How can you not continue to tell the whole story?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So that's how it really got to me. You know?
Yeah, yeah. Tell us another story.
There was this – so Father Joe was sitting in his office and he told me this story off camera, as I said before, and I said it was just so terrible that I just said, look, can I film you telling me that story? So he said, sure. So he basically told the story of these – he said two five-year-old girls were brought into the Mercy Centre.
Can you explain the Mercy Centre to us?
Oh, the Mercy Centre is a place that was founded by Father Joe and Sister Maria in, I think, 1972. And it was a place where kids came, you know, who were abandoned, who were abused, could come and be rescued, and they were housed and accommodated in the place called the Mercy Centre.
And this is in the centre of a huge slum.
Yeah.
In the middle of Bangkok?
Yeah, on the edge, on the skirts of Bangkok, on the skirts of the city. The city is literally 1 kilometre away.
Yeah.
You know, so it's abutting, the slum abuts this 20th century gleaming metropolis.
How many people in the slum?
About 100,000.
Okay. Back to these five-year-old girls.
Yeah, so these five-year-old girls were again, Father Joe had a phone call. They were brought in. He said they came in and they had bruises on the back of their necks. He said they had bruises on the back of their necks where they were forced to have oral sex with the predators that they were sold to. And he said they were taught not to bite because obviously if they bit, they would be in bigger trouble. And he said this went on. This goes on, and those girls today are okay. But we got them when they came into us. Yeah. And this is what I'm talking about. This is Father Joe speaking. What I'm talking about when I say there are these people, these predators, these pedophiles who abuse kids, they should all be taken out and shot.
Mm. Father Joe said that?
Mm.
Old Testament justice. You know, James, it strikes me here that story, the one before, I mean, it's so – a lot of us, I think, would think that we just lose hope being constantly thrown up against situations like that. Can you talk to us about, like, how does Father Joe maintain hope? I mean, you can see how he maintains a certain, you know, fire and passion against the injustice, but, I mean, does he maintain hope as well?
Yeah, he maintains hope by creating schools. There's 33 schools that he's founded and formed, you know, so he's educated thousands and thousands of kids. So education is his big thing. And obviously when he sees kids being educated, it's a beautiful thing for him. A lot of those kids have become graduates at universities over the years, and a lot of them have gone overseas. Mm. And they've got diplomas and degrees and all sorts of things. I think that's where he gets his joy, seeing the kids coming from nowhere and achieving something incredible. And I think that inspires him every day to probably keep going.
Yeah.
You know, and the things like he has a farm outside of Bangkok, Mercy Centre Farm, where they grow vegetables and fruit, and the kids are taught about the land and growth and getting away from the urban dwellings. Mm. And that's also, you know, very good for them and him.
Yeah.
He goes there quite often.
Yeah.
And I think he reflects obviously, when he prays, he reflects and thinks about the things that not only he's done, but all his staff have done. The amount of things that they do, you know, they go out and there's outreach for AIDS. You know, people are suffering from AIDS. They go and visit them. I think they inspire hope in people by doing all these various different things, which are incredible.
But doing, yeah, that's crucial. Does he speak about being grateful?
Grateful. Grateful's a funny word. Grateful. I think he's probably grateful without asking him. I've never asked him that, but he's probably grateful that he's lasted so long, that he's lasted 50 years, because he's a tower of strength, and you need to be a tower of strength in those slums and that heat and that environment to actually affect change and, you know, inspire people to be better than they are.
Yeah.
I think in 50 years he has empowered the entire slum, you know, because all the kids have been through his schools, you know, for over 50 years, and a lot of the community leaders have been through his schools. The slum 50 years ago had no knowledge, had no education, had no future.
Yeah.
Now it's a place where people are empowered and they can fight fights, you know, where, for example, there's talk about the people being displaced, the slum dwellers being displaced to make way for development, because the land is owned by the Port Authority, Thailand Port Authority, and it's very valuable land. They want to build townhouses and hotels and they want to move people out. Well, that was happening, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, but there's been a resistance spearheaded by Father Joe, who's gone, they don't want to go. They don't. If they go, they're going to lose their identity. They're going to lose their community. They're going to lose everything.
Yeah.
And I don't want them to go. They don't want to go.
Yeah.
So the people have stood up and have actually said, no, we don't want to go, and these are the reasons why we're not going.
Yeah.
And they've got the power now to make those decisions, which is incredible.
Yeah, and those are the decisions they make. And it's like Kibera, isn't it?
Yeah, Kibera.
You know, they were given a quote-unquote nicer place to go.
That's right, yeah.
But, and they went back to the slum. And why? Because the environment itself is not what's important. It's the community.
Yeah.
That's important.
Yeah. You might not – Kibera is the great slum. I think it's the greatest slum in Africa now. I think it's 7 km from Nairobi, a city centre. And when the Nairobi Council government, Kenyan government, gave them new dwellings, these were brand spanking new apartments. Only little issue was they weren't flat on the ground. They were one on top of each other. So when the people went out there, got these brand spanking new apartments, the whole geographical positioning on top of each other did not allow them to connect in the same way as they did in the slum. So the people went out there and then duly subcontracted them.
Isn't that fantastic?
So they could go back to the slum, earn the monies from the apartment there, and be with the people.
That's good people business, isn't it? That's good business sense.
James, you said something. There's so many things going through my mind. And first, Chip, geez, mate, you ask such great questions.
Oh, stop it. No, keep going.
The question you had before, mate, I'm emotionally lost. And, mate, the question you came in there with before, it was just sensational. So, mate, just so grateful that you're on board.
Appreciate you, Byrne.
But, James, what you just said before about he's empowered the entire slum, this is saying that please don't let me put the image and etch it in stone, but he's like become their Jesus. He's become their Christ. He's become their center. He's become their leader. How did he do that? How does a person rise to become that person? What did he actually do to earn that adoration from the people?
Through example, I guess, and his wanting to be with the people. He's often said, I don't want to preach from the pulpit. I want to be like Jesus walking the streets. And he does. I've seen him. He walks the streets. I've come behind him with a camera, and he's talking to people. He's walking. He spends 2 or 3 hours maybe, not now because he's older.
Yeah.
But in the early days, he was just walking, striding the slums. Yeah. And you know, people would come up with, Father Joe, you know, he's almost like a saint.
Yeah.
You know? And you could see that, you could see the happiness in all their faces.
Yeah.
And he would have pocket money, you know. He'd have a few little bart in his pocket occasionally. He'd give people a little bit, you know, if somebody is suffering a bit, and, oh, Father Joe, you know, and you, I wouldn't know what they're saying in Thai, but obviously somebody's struggling, and he'd go, oh, it's okay.
Yeah.
Give me a bit of money, you know.
Yeah.
But it's, yeah, I think it's that kindness and the generosity and the compassion that actually made a difference to these wonderful people. And they're all wonderful people. The slum people, people say, oh, it's very dangerous in the slums. And it is. It can be very dangerous because there's drugs and violence and all sorts of stuff. But every time I've been in the slums, these people are just noble and delightful and generous.
Yeah.
Even when they have nothing and it's a boiling, it's like 35 degrees and your head's going to explode, and I've been filming and I'm standing there, my shirt soaked, and a little old lady comes out and goes, excuse me, and puts a little stool out for me to sit on, and then brings me a glass of water. And I go, oh.
Incredible.
And I look at her and I go, oh, my God, you know, this is too much for me, you know. It's like that kindness when people have nothing.
But still giving what they can.
See, there's such powerful images and powerful messages. Right now I'm thinking of principals of schools. And having worked in schools for so many years, the greatest principals that I've seen, the ones that create culture, are the ones that get out of their friggin' office and get out there with the kids in the playgrounds. They greet the kids when they come to school. I'm thinking of the terrific Philip Heath. Hi, Philip, from Barker College, who greets kids when they come to school and he learns that it's their birthday. They don't go to the first lesson. They go to his office so that he can actually celebrate the birthday with all the kids that are having birthday on February the 16th or March the 7th, whatever date it is, you know. This business of leading by being in the trenches, down there with the people, it is it's a commonality amongst those that I've seen that have been effective.
Yeah, I mean, we say, the saying is you got to lead from the front, but you got to lead from in it, don't you? You've got to lead from within.
Yeah.
Forgive my interruption, listeners, you gentle pygmy whales traversing this self-examination sea. But it's Chip here, and I couldn't let that thought pass without putting to you another of my loaded questions. This one's all about getting amongst it. Now, in the podcast, we were talking specifically about leading from in amongst it. But I want to talk about living from in amongst it, because we do a lot of our living remotely these days, don't we? Zoom screens instead of boardrooms, webinars instead of seminars, movie premieres on streaming services instead of in cinemas, food at our doorstep by delivery drivers instead of to our tables by waiters, reams and reams and reams of text across innumerable messaging apps instead of just meeting up with your mates. And is there really any difference between WhatsApp and Facebook Messenger, really? Point is, you don't get much real FaceTime these days, do you? So here's the question, two-part of this one. How many things do you do remotely now that you used to do face-to-face? And how much happier are you now?
In that chosen profession, a priest of God, a priest of Jesus, a sister of Jesus, you know, it's also, if we dwell upon it for a moment, they turn their back also on the attractions and the luxuries of society. And yet they appear to do that not only so willingly, but as if it's not even an issue.
Well, and going on from that, Father Joe lived above the slaughterhouse where the pigs are slaughtered. For 20 years, he lived in a little room, maybe the size of this room, and in the heat, the rats scuttling around, and he lived there because he had a choice. He could go to the seminary with all the other priests, or he could live in the slums. He chose to live in the slums because he wanted to be part of the people. He didn't want to, you know, get up in the morning, you know, put his things, his robes on and leave the seminary and come down from the heights to the slums. He wanted to be part of the slums, part of the people. And he wanted them to be his family. Yeah. He always talks about them as his family. After 20 years, he got very sick. He got pneumonia, nearly died. And they had to actually drag him out. They had to drag him out of that room. And a very wealthy guy built a house for him, which is within the Mercy Centre area.
Yeah.
So, you know, because otherwise he wasn't going to survive.
Well, yeah.
So, and I think even now he sits in that house. The house is beautiful. It's a Thai house made of teak.
You know?
And I've sat in there many times, many evenings, many days, you know, talking to him, interviewing him. He seems pretty content in there, but I get a feeling that he finds it like a false world. You know, he would rather be back in his little room because he's away from them, you know. He's physically away and removed.
Yeah.
I think that this seems like a really important point for me. I'm going to ask James a couple of questions here, and then based on the answer, I think this might be worthy of discussion. So come with me on this adventure, James. So, James, when you talk about Father Joe, it seems like this has become his calling to such an extent that doing this doesn't even seem to him like a choice anymore, right? So that's a little bit difficult for a lot of us to get at, I think. So I'm going to bring it back to you because you've been with this story for 15 years and you keep coming back, and that is largely on you. You have to keep making that decision to stick with this. So for our listeners, can you talk us through your thought process that keeps you coming back, that keeps that discipline in place?
Well, firstly, the first thing is I don't like giving up on anything. So I'd never give up. So I continue and continue and continue till I drive people nuts and I get to where I have to go, you know? And in a way, Father Joe's a bit similar. The similarities between me and Father Joe are, you know, he's an outsider. I'm an outsider in the slums.
Mm-hmm.
He's white. I'm white. We're both male. I think he has imposter syndrome for sure. So do I.
What does that mean?
Imposter syndrome, meaning you're kind of not worthy to be doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know? So to be worthy, you have to kind of keep thinking about, oh, shit, I am worthy. I think I am anyway. So there are a lot of similarities, and I think that fascinates me. So I keep going back to kind of almost discover more about myself because I see myself reflected a bit in Father Joe.
Yeah.
I don't say I'm as good as he is or I do what he does or I'm as unselfish and altruistic as he is, but every time I leave him and I walk down the street of the slum to get a taxi and I'm going away, I've been there for a few days, every time I go away, there's a hint of sadness, but there's a great deal of inspiration. And I feel like I've been with somebody special and I feel like I've been doing something special and I've been privileged to have access to a group of people that are just amazing human beings. You know, I'm talking about the slum dwellers. I'm talking about the staff at the Mercy Centre. Yeah. I'm talking about all the people there who greet you and, you know, sawadikap, sawadikap, you know, and they're just so delightful and you feel like you're part of the family. So I know what Father Joe means, you know. It's like I now have an extended family and that's probably what makes me want to keep returning.
Community. Yeah.
Do you actually, when you leave, do you actually feel as if you're leaving the best of you behind you?
To some degree, yeah, I think so. But I'm But what I've got in the camera is some memories. Yeah. So maybe am I making this film just for my own personal, you know, photo video album, or am I making the film for the rest of the world? And I obviously am making the film for the rest of the world. I never started off making this film in the beginning. It wasn't about me. It was about the Mercy Centre, and it was about giving back to them, and making short films for them to use to raise donations and money to run the Mercy Centre. As the years went on, I started thinking, God, I've got so much footage. What am I going to do with all this footage, you know? Once I started thinking like that, I thought, well, there's a bigger story here, and I better write a script up so I can see where I am in the story.
Yeah.
And that's what I did. So now I've got the script written, I've done all the filming, and I've got to get into post-production.
You know? Yeah, we're not going to talk about post-production and the opportunities we've got just yet. I don't want to wind this up. Father Joe, the blend of humanity, the raw, the passionate, the violent, the assertive, the aggression, this you've even referred to before, that he imposter syndrome, and yet here he is, this Catholic priest. I heard you talking about him being prayerful before. How did the blend of all that, how does that come together in the mix of that?
So from time to time, I would see him in different guises. I'd see him saying Mass. I'd see him comforting a child or a mother. I'd see him getting ready for Mass one day, filming it with a Down syndrome guy, Galang, who's been at the Mercy Centre probably for 40 years, and he's now 60 or something.
Yeah.
But Galang is delightful. He runs around, he holds Father. They walk hand in hand. He holds his hand and they walk around, you know. And Galang is just, he's delightful, you know. And I filmed him dressing Father Joe for Mass one day, and it was hysterical. He's trying to help him put his robes on, and he was getting the head in the through the sleeve, and it was like Father Joe was just laughing his head off, you know. And Galang was going, "Oh, you know, I'm trying to do the best I can," and he's and it just went on for 15 minutes. I just kept filming it, and I just thought, this is just a beautiful moment, you know, of humanity.
Yeah,
and Father Joe's innate kindness, you know? There are other times when I've seen him berating and abusing people who've done the wrong thing, such as a photographer who got access to the slaughterhouse where they slaughter the pigs. That's a sacred place. You cannot go there. You cannot go in there. Even for me, I had to beg over days and months to actually get permission. And even then, he said, "You've got 30 seconds.
Yeah.
And I thought, "Good Jesus, I better get the camera in focus before I button on and press the button." And I'm going, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20. I'm thinking, "Shit, get whatever you can, get the coverage." And then there was nothing. Nobody said anything. So I thought, "Oh, I've gone past 30. I'm up to a minute now. I can get a wider shot now. I can get a couple more tilt downs. And so.
Kid in a candy store.
And that was great. So even for me, it was hard, you know. But this guy had got in under false pretenses, had used somebody's card, and had bought everybody in there a slab of beer, got them all pissed, and got them stabbing the pigs with knives, and took photos to sell on the internet.
Mm.
Now, Father Joe found out about this and called him in, basically. And he said, "Oh, why should I come in?" He said, "Well, you're going to come in because a couple of friends of mine are ex-IRA and they know where you live.
Yeah.
And so if you don't come in, you know, I don't know what's going to happen." So he was there within an hour and he came in. I said, "Father Joe, can I film this?"
Yeah.
He said, sure, film it, you know. Yeah. So the guy arrives and he's this creepy Dutch photographer, you know.
Yeah.
And he comes in and he sees me with the camera and he's going, "What are you doing? What are you filming?" And I sort of backed off so he couldn't get with the camera. And a couple of the burly bodyguards, Father Joe's, you know, warlords.
Muscle.
Just pulled him aside. And, you know, "Dear boy, don't just leave James alone." And then, you know, the guy walks in and Father Joe gets stuck into him. You know, "What were you doing? You've cheated. You've betrayed us. You've gone in there. You've taken these photographs. You're going to get them down off the internet and they're going to come down straight away. And I want all the photographs here within the next couple of hours."
Yeah.
And the guy's, he's cocky, he's arrogant, he's just horrible. You know, I can see it through my lens. He's just, there's no remorse. He's just going, oh, we're so big deal, you know.
Have you captured this?
I have.
Wow.
I have. And then Nitya, whose card he used a business card to get in, she's crying, going, she's crying over there. Father Jones screaming abuse at him, like, you're going to go to jail. You are going to go to jail if I don't get those photos, you know. And this is all going on. So so the contrast of the nice Father Joe, if you rile him up, he gets very riled up. And then I continued out, because when you're behind a camera, you get lost in that world. And they got him into the van. They took him to the police station. I just got in the van and followed. And I'm following. He said, what are you? And he's trying to get me again. He's trying to, you know, and there's a hand that just pushes him away.
What was the outcome?
Well, we get to the police station. And I follow him into the interrogation room. I'm still behind the camera. And we're in the interrogation room, and I'm going, you know, here we go. And about after 2 minutes of him being interrogated, he gets a tap on the I get a tap on the shoulder saying, "Excuse me, no filming in here." I say, "Oh, I'm terribly sorry, you know." So I walk out.
Yeah.
So what happened was he returned all the photos, and you know.
Wow.
But it was. Hell of a story, but I've seen him a few times like that.
He's been
like that with me too.
Yeah,
he's in an interview situation where, you know, I've asked him the same question over and over again. Like, so Father Joe, tell me, are you winning the war in the slums? You know, are you winning the drugs and the violence? Are you winning that war? And he just went absolutely berserk. He said, "This pisses me off. This pisses me off. Why can't you ask me a decent question? Why can't you ask me what about all the good things we're doing?" And he turned around at the camera to his right, and he went, "And you can effing keep recording." And he turned back to me, and you know, and I'm sitting there thinking, you know, when somebody's attacking you, the first thing you want to do is defend yourself.
Yeah.
And I could feel the blood. I could feel actually the blood rising in my throat.
Yeah.
And I thought, I'm almost going to say something back. I'm going to get him, you know, because he's just abusing the shit out of me.
Yeah.
So I'm sitting there, but I'm thinking, James, just be calm. Just take it easy. It'll be over in a second.
Yeah.
If you attack him or defend yourself, the whole thing will be over.
Yeah.
The film will be over. It'll be finished. Finito bonito.
Yeah.
So I just waited, and then when he'd finished ranting and raving, the cameras kept rolling
because
he told them to. Effing keep rolling. So the boys kept the cameras going.
Yeah.
And I'm sitting there, and I thought my next question had better be a reasonable one. You know? So I said, "Father Joe, tell me, what do you think's been your greatest achievement?"
No, he's a swami. No, he's a guru.
No, that's a better question.
Yeah.
But tell me the – in both those stories of his irate nature, the expression of aggression there, the end result and the outcome was actually how dare you not honor the love that we have for the people. You know, he is still assertive and aggressive for the cause.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and again, I'm looking at you, Chip, because I got the Tim Alexander model again, where it was inferred that to love at times means that the other face of love is that assertion. Mm. It is that aggression. And they're blood brothers, their relatives, their families, their sisters, because they are united by the one cause.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, the one injustice.
And for Tim's episode, you actually wrote in the title, "Love and Aggression, a Brother and Sister," and to just put a button on that analogy and everything you said there, they've got the same parent.
Yeah.
Right. And getting back to what you, Byrne, said about the difference between heart speak and head speak, I think when you're doing genuine heart speak, which is what Father Joe seems to be really good at, you're showing people what you love.
Yeah.
Now, you can do that directly, or like Father Joe does and like what Tim's talking about, you can show the fury you have when what you love is threatened.
Yeah.
You're still showing people what you love there, though.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's heart speak.
Yeah. But I'm even thinking about what you just say there, Chip, and in the back of my mind is the translation of that down to even everyday life.
Mm.
How many people in home are afraid to speak
the stuff that needs to be spoken about, that's swept under the carpet, and it's a draw between loving couples. Mm. And yet, what you've just said there is, if the intent is to honor the love that we have by having the guts and the courage to speak about the stuff that sometimes we would prefer not be spoken about, then people should hear the intent.
Yeah, well said. Well said. That's exactly it.
So let us not be afraid. Let us back ourselves to speak openly, honestly, transparently, when the intent is for progression. The intent is to honor love that exists between us. And, you know, same principle I'm hearing in two different circumstances. You know,
and
thank you, Father Joe.
Yeah, and I think also always try to be looking for that good intent.
Yeah,
if you're always assigning bad intentions to people, everyone's miserable. Always look for that. You might be wrong sometimes, but try to find the good intent.
Yeah. Versus, am I saying this to protect my ego?
Yeah.
Versus, am I saying this to protect because I need to be seen to be right? You know, what is my intent to speak so honestly and openly and so transparently? Darling, it's because I love you. That's why I want to have this chat. It's because I'm feeling that our love is eroding. That's why I have this chat. Father Joe, it's because how dare you erode the love that we have for the people, Mr. Dutchman? Because that's not erodible. that can't be diluted, you know.
Forgive my second interruption, listeners, you bouncy springboks on this wide savannah of self-reflection, but it's Chip here, and I couldn't let that thought pass without putting to you another of my loaded questions, and this one's going to unsettle you. Are you ready? We've all got them in our lives, don't we? We've probably got quite a few, actually. What am I talking about? Talking about those tough, honest, transparent conversations that we know we should have, that we need to have with some of the people in our lives in order to resolve conflicts or take a relationship to the next level. And yet, we never have those conversations. Those conversations just seem too hard to get started. So here's the question. If you were forced tomorrow to have a tough, transparent, vulnerable conversation with an important person in your life, what words would you use to start that conversation that would make absolutely sure that that person knew that you were having this conversation because you wanted the best for them?
You've already created a film. You've got a small film, haven't you, that you created that in my mind, hearing about it is sort of like an entree to what we're going to expect in this wonderful film that I know you're going to make, and it is going to be out there. Tell us about the short film.
Yeah, the short film was called Through the Eyes of Children, which is a 13, 14-minute film, and it's won lots of awards. It's won, and I'll tell you a story. I went to Dublin a few years ago, like 2019. I go to a conference once a year with all these filmmakers, with some of the best producers, directors in the world. And we're in Dublin because we have a yearly conference in a different country. And I thought, what am I going to take this year? You know, because everybody takes a recent film they've made. So I thought, I'll take it through the eyes of children, you know. So I roll up to this conference. And of course, there's guys there with, you know, huge feature films and TV series, and what you do is you present your film and then you explain how you made it. On the Monday and Tuesday, there's a couple of people up there and they're showing these feature films and these TV, and I'm going, oh God, man, how am I going to get up and show this film? it's like chalk and cheese, you know. It's like, oh,
imposter syndrome.
Well, there you go. Yeah. So anyway, I got up and thought, oh, just do it, Jimmy Christ, get on with it. So I stood up and said, oh, yeah, put this film together. I did this. And then Little Dot Studios, you know, got me to find the kids today, and I did that, and blah, blah, blah. This is how the story came together, and I'll show you the film. So I go to the back of the auditorium. There's 100 people, distinguished producers, directors, you know, hell of a crowd, right? And the film came on two huge screens. And I hadn't seen it with an audience, let alone on a big screen, you know. So I stood at the back of the auditorium and I'm thinking, oh, gosh, you know, like, you know, I don't know how this is going to go down. Anyway, I came out the front at the end of the film for Q&A and I said, any questions? And I looked around the room. They were all crying. Everyone had tears rolling down their cheeks. And I just went, I don't know. I don't, well, what? And one guy picked up a microphone and said, James, I want to ask.
Nailed him.
I just went, yeah. Oh, my God. And the outcome of that was that every year the Walter Klein Trophy, who started this organization up 60 years ago, the International Quorum of Motion Picture Producers, there's a trophy for the most inspirational film.
Mm-hmm.
Guess who won it?
Is that right?
Yeah.
Mr. Jimmy Lingwood.
Yeah, and just, I was just, you know.
Wow. With that film?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, they're all just blown away. You
yeah.
know? So that's the power of film.
And what did James Lingwood on that moment, that day and the days that followed, what did he learn about himself as a result of that experience? What did you said before you might have had imposter syndrome and yet you have this incredible experience. What did you learn about you then?
God, that was a bloody hero.
Humility.
Bugger the humility. Let's get dancing, folks. Let's enjoy the old trophy. Lingy, good on you, mate.
Good on you.
Yeah. Ah, good on you, mate. No, look, it's I think everybody's got a touch of imposter syndrome, you know. Everybody's got a touch from time to time, I'm not good enough or whatever. But that day was particularly poignant because of the huge films, these yeah. amazing masterpieces these guys had produced.
Yeah.
And I thought, oh, well, I've just got a little video. You know, it's like, it's not really competition, you know.
Yeah.
But somehow it doesn't matter what medium you're on.
Mm.
If you're telling a story that hits somebody's heart and soul, that's when there's an emotional resonance and connection, which is fantastic. And it's like life itself.
Yeah.
If you meet somebody and you can connect with them on an emotional level. How wonderful is that?
Yeah. I want to end on a Father Joe story, and I've got that question in mind. But before we go to that ending, if we have a listener out there, if somehow through this podcast, this experience here, we can be the catalyst for the raising of monies that are required to take this incredible story into the homes of the globe. How do we do it? What are you calling for? Give us the dot I's, cross T's. I want to hear every bit of what needs to be done so that someone can watch this film in their own home.
Okay. There's about 60 or 70 hours of footage that has been shot. That footage needs to be now edited. And it's what you call post-production.
Mm.
So you go into post-production and you edit the film. You then have to color grade. You have to do a sound mix. You have to get a music composition. You have to get a narration and several other bits and pieces, which totals to about $340,000.
Okay.
So that's the money we require to actually finish the film.
How do we donate?
The Australian Documentary Foundation, which has a link to this project, which is called A Light in the Slaughterhouse.
One more time.
The Australian Documentary Foundation, which has a link to the film, which is called A Light in the Slaughterhouse.
Yep.
And when people go to that, there's a donate button and they can hit the donate button and donate whatever they want, basically.
Yeah. Mm. Is this tax deductible?
It's 100% tax deductible.
Wow.
Because the Australian Documentary Foundation is a charity registered organisation.
Yeah.
So, and there's several other projects in there as well.
Yeah.
But this link takes you directly to the film. You can read about the film. You can see a couple of trailers. And you can donate.
It's got to be individuals, high net worth individuals out there, companies out there who need a tax deductible receipt. Mm. $340,000, forgive me, it's not much, you know. So That'd be great. And Chip, we'll have that in the event description, the Absolutely. Show notes, etc.
Show notes on your
of this episode.
Here. So it's a 90-minute feature documentary. So 90 minutes.
Yeah,
it's quite a long time, you know, to edit. So I've had some people along the way. You know you're doing the right thing by people supporting you. I've had Channel 7 up at Mount Coota transferring a range of tapes from the old DV cams, you know, 15 years ago, from DVDs, different things, different formats we've used. You know, they did that for like at cost.
Yeah.
And it took, I don't know how many hours it took, but it was a lot of footage.
Yeah.
I've had interns from Griffith putting all the files together, organizing the files on the hard drives. They're still going. We just finished, actually, and then working out timelines. So we're going to start editing on Saturday, I think.
Mm.
And they're all interns, and they're doing it for nothing. And
isn't that wonderful?
Yep, and animators. I've got three girls who are doing the animation from Griffith. They're all in the animation class.
Yeah.
And they're not easy animations, you know. And they're just doing it because they want to do it.
Yeah.
I just find all that phenomenal. So it gives me a lot of power and a feeling that I'm doing the right thing, you know.
Mm. But the clock has come back on itself because you learned from the French films.
I did.
And here's my guess is for some of those interns, they'll be learning through your film. You know, who knows how you'll be influencing these young people with the opportunity to actually see this story and to understand it and to be a part of it.
Well, the girl who edited Through the Eyes of Children was working with another editor, a friend of mine, because I put a call out to Griffith for editors to come and work on Through the Eyes of Children, right?
Yeah.
There's about four answered the call to action, and I like one in particular. Mm. Her name was Jordan Hanney.
Mm.
Geordie came in and she just worked tirelessly, and I just thought, God, has she got a future, you know? What I loved about her was the fact that she'd sometimes be, maybe she'd be sick one day, but she'd still come in.
Yeah.
I'd say, no, don't come in if you're sick. You know, she just wanted to do it.
Yeah.
She did such a great job. And through that, Bob then gave her more work.
Yeah.
Because he edited Steve Irwin's Crocodile Hunter. You know, he's editing stuff now. Mm. But she worked with him for a while, so she got some good mentoring.
Yeah.
Now she's in Sydney.
Yeah.
Doing all the, you know, Survivor and all the reality shows, and, you know, she's on some big time stuff.
So
you never know where it leads.
Like, wow.
Mm.
Last story, Father Joe. And I've held this one back because I think it's so relevant to what we see in our world today, yeah? Father Joe was a Catholic priest, and he empowered a whole community called the slum in Bangkok. And yet in that slum, I think even your reference to the slaughterhouse with housed pigs for slaughter, maybe also a reference to religiosity. Hinduism, in an Islamic community, I'd imagine, may have also existed in the slum. And yet somehow I'm imagining that this priest was not impacted, or he actually played a role in, regardless of religious faith, where people were able to be as one and find community. Is that a fair comment? The question is, in the light of what's happening in our world, and we can think of you know, Palestine and Israel, and you know, what's happening in Northern Europe. How did he do it? Like, how did religions forget their own passion of righteousness to actually see brotherhood and equity, even though there were different faiths? Because this is a message that the world continually needs to hear, I imagine. Yeah?
Yeah. Well, in the slums, there are Buddhists, Muslims, and Christians.
Yeah.
And there's an imam who who's the head of the Muslim community. There's the abbot, who's in charge of the Buddhists, and Father Joe, who's the Christian boy, you know. And the three of them meet regularly and discuss the community and ways in which they can improve things and make people's lives better. And I have filmed all of them and interviewed each and every one of them. And I think Father Joe is like the glue that brings them together. I don't think the imam and the abbot meet very regularly, but I think Father Joe meets with each of them individually and as a group.
Yeah.
And somehow he brings his highly evolved humanity to the fore. I think they've seen what he's done, and they're witness to this extraordinary human being who's put all these kids through school and has saved, you know, all these kids who have been abandoned and sexually abused. They don't do that, but they have their own people that they look after, obviously.
Yeah.
They see what Father Joe has done, and through that, I think they are, you know, they're in awe of him, as most people are.
Yeah. Mm. Do you detect in any way that they have been empowered by Father Joe and they have therefore found a more profound way, a more effective way for they as head of their religions to be effective?
Probably.
Yeah.
But I haven't really drilled down to that. But I see where in their interactions there's a great deal of, this amazing empathy, the way they look at him, the way that they feel around, the way they are around him.
Yeah.
I think there's a great deal of respect, you know. But I've always said in the film, I'm going to bring the point up that these people are all living in harmony. Well, how come all these different religions can live in harmony when the rest of the world is fighting tooth and nail over territory, over whatever it might be, you know?
Yeah.
Greed has gone crazy. And I think it's time for people to realize to go back and look at what they're doing in the slums to get some kind of reference to the reality of living a proper and good life.
Yeah.
One of the things Father Joe said to me, in fact, he said this to me a few years ago, we were walking, I think it was in Sydney when he'd just been doing some funding. He said to me, and it was a bit off, I'm not sure whether I recorded it or not, but he said something like, you know, I'm going to miss this filming because you have been like a Samuel Pepys diarist and you have been recording almost my every move for so long.
Yeah.
When you're not there,
it's
going to feel strange.
Yes.
And I thought, wow, you know.
Yeah,
you're part of the story now. Mm.
Yeah, mm. yeah. Mm. I read recently where in the book it just had a simple paragraph that said, and I'm making this up now, you know, Islam is fighting Christianity, Christianity is fighting whoever, you know, whatever religious wars are on, and one religion fights the other in the name of God and the other religion responds in the name of God. And yet here they are both fighting for ultimately the same God. Well, it's a different God in their eyes, but ultimately the same recognition of a higher force.
Yeah.
And probably in both eyes, a God who is meant to be love.
And it's funny, one of Father Joe's favourite quotes is, Jesus is a highly evolved Buddha.
Whoa!
Which is kind of, you know, coming out
fusion.
Of the mouth of a, you know, Catholic priest. Sorry, Father Joe, I had to say it.
Yeah. Oh, that's wonderful. Well, Chipster, mate, I am so glad you what did you do? Put his hand around his back and said, please come back, James.
A little bit. There was a little bit of that. Just grabbed his pinky.
Which one?
It looked like the left, but you're slippery.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, James, you know, as we wind up, I don't want to be a person here that sort of like sits in hope that your film becomes a publicized fruition. It just must. These are stories that are not just of one man, as great as the man is, but it's a story that the world needs to hear and see, because it's a story of love personified. And everyone's on that journey, surely. We think they are anyway, but we're just naive, two humble guys, Chip, who think there's a better way. But surely, ultimately, you know, everybody wants to know, you know, how can I bring more happiness to my existence by becoming a more loving human being? Well, let it be demonstrated through the story of Father Joe and your lens. Your lens that has captured that over 15 years. And, mate, you've been with us for about an hour and a half this morning. And good news is I don't think I will be editing this down to the usual hour, listeners. So
I
right
knew
now,
he couldn't do it. I knew he couldn't bring himself to do it.
Today it may be a little bit longer. But
well, you're both going to be coming to the premiere, I hope, you know, of the film. That'd be rather... Yeah,
just try and stop me.
The Q&A, you know, when absolutely. I'm doing the Q&A, please don't start crying, you know.
Mate, yeah, well, dare I say it, and I don't mind saying it, but my tears are everyone's tears, mate. And I don't know what possesses me to say that just as Father Joe's passion is everyone's passion, you know. You can have my tears, dear listeners. Hey, buddy, thank you for inspiring the tears, mate. What a great morning. And, mate, if our podcast never earns 1 cent, who cares when we're on the receiving end of this type of education?
Allah Akbar, salam alaikum, alaikum salam.
Chip, tell him to shut up, will you?
That's enough, Jimmy. That's enough, Jimmy.
His part is, Chip, turn him down right now, mate. I don't want that.
You're incorrect. That's the right call. Oh, turn it up. He's gone. He's gone.
Are you sure he's gone?
He's gone.
Mate, just get out of the room, will you?
Yeah.
Chip, mate, I am so grateful, mate. Wasn't that sensational?
Yeah, that was great. That was phenomenal. There was so much in there. It's dense. Do you feel the density in the room?
Well, mate, density, I just feel as if I've been on a journey, a trip.
You've been on a roller coaster.
An adventure. All in an hour and a half this morning, you know. What an incredible, beautiful story. It's, you know, it's Mother Teresa, it's a Nelson Mandela, it's a Martin Luther King, you know. It's all of that captured through the eyes of a lens held by, you know, James Lingwood.
Jimmy Lingwood. Yeah. It's stories within stories within stories. It's the story of the slum. It's the story of Father Joe. It's the story of James as well.
Yeah.
And it's clearly impactful if you're a little episodes or anything that go by. And how good was that, listeners, by the way?
Hey, you know, I often speak blindly when I get a little emotional, you know, but we just got to play our role, mate,
in making
sure that film somehow gets to where it's meant to be. Now, 100%. I ain't got 340 grand to give away, but we've got to put out on a thinking hats as to how we can be a catalyst for that money being raised.
Absolutely. Just chuck in a bit. You don't need to get it there. Look, I'll start. I'm going to chuck some in.
Yeah.
Boom.
Yeah.
Easy.
So let's just work that out. If we had 340 people, 680 by 500, if we had 1,000 people, that's 340. We'll work it out.
Yeah.
We'll work it out.
The maths just scrambled me.
Talking about working things out, mate, have you got something to work out?
Oh, I've got too much to work out.
Mate, how are you going to bring that down to a few actionables?
I'll have to see. I mean, there's purpose, there's love, there's joy, there's community.
Compassion,
you know what?
There's leadership.
Yeah.
You know? And they're just the themes, mate. And, you know, I want them drilled down to sub-principles, mate. Little steps that we need to take tomorrow in order to become that more joyful and best of luck, Chip. Best of luck.
Thanks, Bern, and thank you, listeners, you stoic kelp geese aloft on the migratory winds of internal insight. Thank you so much for staying with us for another edition of Chip's Take Home Pay, and joining me, Chip Lachlan Huddy, for the wrap-up, the sign-off, the Take Home Pay for this episode, where I try to pull together the most impactful themes of the podcast you just listened to and offer some hard, fast, concrete action steps so that you can start applying the wisdom of our guests to your own life, not next week, not tomorrow, but right now and today. I think we have to revisit and revise a few of our favourite topics, because I think that Father Joe's story throws new light on them and the profoundly powerful connections between them. And those topics are values, purpose, and community. Now let's start with values, and it's worth a refresher because the word values is bandied about so much. But what do we really mean when we're talking about values? So let's nail that down. From the Oxford Dictionary, values are principles or standards of behavior, one's judgment of what is important in life. So you can see how useful identifying your values is, because they'll illuminate what's important to you, and they'll also direct you toward actions that will enable you to live by those values. And it's when our actions are in accordance with our values that we're fulfilling our purpose. Now, in the case of Father Joe, what's his primary value, do you think? It's up for debate, but here's my take. Alleviating suffering. Now, I was toying with saying that his primary value was fighting injustice. And I think that works, but I don't think it's clarified enough. Because what does injustice cause that makes it so intolerable? Well, it causes suffering. So it's not the fight against injustice, it's the ending of suffering. That's important. That's the clarified value. And that's a value, I reckon, that's powered Father Joe's life's purpose of helping some of the neediest people in the world. So you see how that works? How powerful that simple connection is? A clarified value, it is good to alleviate suffering, leads to a definitive purpose to comfort and uplift some of the neediest people in the world. And in Father Joe's case, that purpose has propelled his actions, his day-to-day life, for 50 years, living amongst the people of Klong Toei. Which brings us to the final piece of the puzzle, community. Because would it have been enough to sustain Father Joe for 50 years simply to be living his purpose every day? Maybe. Can't say for sure, but what I can say is it would have been extremely hard to do it alone, which is where community comes in. And there's a lesson here, and you can hear it especially clearly when James talks about the other religious leaders in the slums and how they seem to be in awe of Father Joe, how Father Joe seems to be the glue that holds these groups together. And I think the lesson there is, when you live your purpose so strongly, people can't help but be attracted to you. Purpose is magnetic. It builds community. And then, and this is just me talking, but this is Chip's take-home pay, so do indulge me, then it seems to become a feedback loop. The community provides support and also accountability. And the support and accountability make living the purpose easy. Indeed, they make it almost inevitable to keep living the clarified values that gave birth to the purpose that built the community. So say it with me, because this seems important, guys, and it goes in this order. Clarified values, purpose, community. So those, it seems clear to me, both from Father Joe's story and from the manifold pieces of wisdom from every other podcast guest so far, those are the parts and the process that lead to a sustainable, meaningful life. Clarified values, purpose, community. So how do you and I get a piece of that? Well, the fantastic news is I don't even have to bore you with a scientific study this week, because the ingredients and the method are already there. They're baked in. So you're probably already thinking this through for yourself. But allow me to give you the action steps right up front, because that's what I'm here for. Step one, clarify your values. Now, how do we do this? It's a process of self-questioning. I recommend writing it down. Writing it down crystallizes thoughts, makes thoughts concrete. It's just a good process. So you begin with the question, what's important to me? So write down everything that comes to mind. Now, there'll be a lot of things and there'll be a lot of overlap, but that's the point. Because by paying attention to those overlapping parts, you'll be able to start honing in on those things that are the most important to you, because they'll keep popping up again and again. So the goal here should be
to whittle your list of values down to no more than three really strong, really resonant ones that have arisen from those overlapping parts of everything you wrote down at the start, okay? And to those values, you must now apply the following question with rigor and persistence. And that question is, why? Ask yourself, why is this important to me? And then write down the answer. Then ask yourself again, why? And write down that answer. Now, the point of this is to distill the value down to its purest, dare I say, clearest form. And I'll give you an example. And I always steal a good idea when I see it. So I'm stealing this one from Mr. Bernie Kelly himself. And Bernie used to think that he valued lifelong learning. But then a former podcast guest got him to dig deeper and ask why he valued lifelong learning. And Bernie realized that he valued lifelong learning because he valued the pursuit of wisdom, which is a much deeper, a more foundational thing than simply learning. So it's a subtle difference, but it's a profound one too. The first value is a bit vague. The second was crystal clear. So keep asking why. Why do I find this value important? Ask that until you hit the foundation, when the question of why becomes unnecessary, when you can get no deeper. That's when you know you've found a clarified value. Okay? Okay, second step, take that clarified value and ask yourself, what actions can I now take that will manifest this value, this purpose in the real world? So for Father Joe, who wanted to alleviate suffering, it was to go to a part of the world where people were suffering deeply and rampantly and begin to lift those people up through ministry, through charity, through education, through all these things. So ask yourself that. What actions can I now take that will manifest this value, this purpose in the real world? Okay? Third step, last one, I promise. Ask yourself now, where are the people who will most benefit from me doing these actions that will manifest this purpose? Because that's the crucial final step to complete the circuit. That is the step that will begin to create the community that will crystallize around, benefit from, and make you accountable to your purpose. And there you go. Circuit complete. Feedback looping. You've just set up a self-sustaining mechanism to make a meaningful life inevitable. Now, to be clear, you don't have to hightail it to one of the worst slums in Thailand to live your purpose, or to at least start living your purpose. For you, it could be as simple as setting up a fairer division of labor at the neighborhood horticultural society. Okay, could be as cozy as setting up a book club for underserved romanticy fans. The point is, it must incorporate those three key steps. A clarified value leading to a strong purpose, which builds a motivated community around that purpose. Because when you can do that, you can bring light to anywhere in this world. Even, dare I say it, a slaughterhouse. All right, that's all from me, beautiful people. I'm Chip Huddy. This has been Chip's Take Home Pay, and I do hope you found some pay worth taking home. As always, my friends, auf Wiedersehen, and just remember,
Blooper time.
Chip Huddy.
Bernie Kelly.
How did you do it?
This feels like a trap. What are you?
Mate, you brought him back.
Yeah. Oh, okay. I wined him. I dined him. I took him to Moo Moo's in the city.
But, mate, we've been so darn busy lately. We don't need to do repeats.
Don't we? This is I defy you, sir. A repeat? No, this
mate,
is.
Before we get as to why we've got James Ringwood back in this studio here, mate, how busy has it been?
Did you say Ringwood or Lingwood?
Let's start again.
He's sitting right
I was
here.
About to connect you there. He's
sitting right here.
Held my breath.
We're going to start
it
again.
It wasn't my turn to speak.
You know.
Oh, we're off to a flight start.
Mr. Ringwood, what is your game and your name?
Is that a type of tapeworm?
Chip, this is a blooper, right? We've got to use this one.
It's
all right, start again, please, mate.
All right, here we are.